I call the Agriculture Policy Committee to order. Ask the members that are present to take their seats. I think we have a quorum, so Representative Heidegger, would you care to move the minutes?
I so move. Thank you.
Minutes have been moved. Any questions? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Contrary? Motion is carried. Members, today we have four bills on our agenda, so hopefully we can move along. I know we got a few minutes late to start with the session and everybody getting back over here and in order. So the first bill we're going to consider is House File 2442, and I'm going to ask Representative Blaine if he would come and take the gavel, and I will go and present the bill.
Representative Swenson, if you will proceed to introduce your bill.
Mr. Chairman, the first bill deals with farm liens and central notification systems. I'm just going to make a few comments on the bill. This bill makes changes to current Minnesota law that established a central notification system for farm product liens in the Secretary of State's office. The central notification system we use today was set up over a decade ago. It has worked quite well ever since for lenders, producers, and farm product buyers. It provides farm lenders with an easy and convenient way of letting buyers know when there's a lien on certain farm products. It is also a convenient way for buyers of farm products to tell when they need to write a check to both the seller and the lender. This bill makes the current CNS law consistent with amendments we made to the Universal Commercial Code and related farm product lien statutes over the past 3 years. It also conforms our laws to changes made at the federal level in 2002. In 2000, the legislature updated Article 9 of the UCC. In 2001, we recodified old laws relating to farm product liens to make them consistent and easier to understand. In 2002, the Congress made changes to the federal laws governing the CNS so states could allow the use of computers and the Internet for filing documents with the Secretary of State. A task force of farm lenders, farm product buyers, farm organizations, and the State Bar Association have been working on this bill and the earlier changes for nearly 5 years. When the CNS system was first proposed, it met with a good deal of controversy. However, since the system got up and running, users have come to appreciate its value. So when this bill was developed, older users came to the table to work on the changes. They included legal practitioners from the farm law section of the bar, a professor from Hamline University, lenders from the Minnesota Bankers Association, the independent community banks, and farm credit services, buyers from the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association, farm organizations, including the Farm Bureau, the Farmers Legal Action Group, soybean growers, pork producers, and Crop Retailers Association, County Recorders Association, and the Secretary of State's office. What we are doing here is updating and improving an already effective system used by lenders and farm product buyers across the state. With me to provide further testimony are two of the people who worked on the bill over the past few years. First is Mr. Philip Kunkel, a lawyer with Gray Plant Moody and an expert in agriculture law. Mr. Chairman, I would ask that we call on Mr. Kunkel for further testimony.
Mr. Kunkel, if you will state your name for the tape and proceed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Philip Kunkel. I'm an attorney with the Gray Plant Moody Law Firm in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As Representative Swenson has indicated, this bill is before you today as represents the work product of a task force that has been working on this for the past several years. Probably the best way to approach this is to explain what this bill does and what this statute does, because it's pretty confusing unless you practice in this area on a daily basis. Essentially, what this bill does is implement federal legislation, which was enacted in the late 1980s as a means to protect buyers of farm products, purchasers of livestock and grain who bought livestock and grain from producers. Back in those days, we had a number of cases where buyers and the lenders to those producers became embroiled in a great deal of litigation over whether or not the producer took that grain and livestock free of security interests. Congress, in 1986, enacted legislation which provided protection for those buyers and then turned it back to the states with giving the states an option to enact a central notification system, as we did here in Minnesota. In the 2002 Farm Bill, Congress made some changes to that federal legislation, specifically allowing and permitting electronic filing of those financing statements and records in order to expedite and make the system more efficient. At the same time, as Chairman Swenson has indicated, we enacted in Minnesota some revisions to Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code in 2000. And so this bill is an effort to try to bring those two statutes together and enhance the efficiency of this system. The lenders, the lending community, the buyers of farm products, and the producers, I think, have all become accustomed to the operation of this system. And we're all involved in the task force that was mentioned earlier. I chaired that task force on behalf of the State Bar Association, and I think it's safe to say that everybody gave a little bit in order to pull this together. The changes that have been made are, for the most part, based upon the revisions to Article 9 and the federal statute. They will allow for electronic filing of records by lenders and buyers to obtain information and protect themselves. Probably most importantly, they will allow and permit the central notification system operated by the Secretary of State's office to provide that information electronically to the users of the system. So it'll be electronic communication going both ways, which will be cheaper and more efficient for all the parties involved in the system. The bill also recognizes some expanded and new products that are being produced here in Minnesota. It contemplates a new form, finally, the other change is that it integrates satellite offices, which will be operated by the county recorders, under the umbrella of the central filing system operated by the Secretary of State. So those are probably the highlights of the bill. As Chairman Swenson had indicated, it has been through several redrafts and discussions and meetings by virtually all of the parties who are affected, and as far as we know, there's no opposition to the bill. There's a quirk in the bill that you'll see regarding the effective date. Because the bill implements federal law, under the federal statute, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is required to certify our system. So the bill contemplates that it will take effect on February 1st in the year following approval by the USDA. We chose February 1st primarily because of annual crop production. We didn't want the law changing in the middle of a growing season, and we wanted to give everyone plenty of notice. We don't know if it'll be approved by the USDA this year so that it take effect in 05, or if it'll be pushed out to 2006, but I just wanted to call that to your attention.
Mr. Chairman, I think I neglected to move the bill before we started. I would move that House File 2542, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law.
Okay. Representative Swenson, House Bill 2442 moves House Bill 2442 and upon passage be sent to the Civil Law Committee.
Go ahead.
Representative Swenson, you had a comment.
No, I guess I was just going to introduce the next testifier unless you're going to have questions first.
Why don't we...
I guess Mr. Kunkel just informed me that Bert Black is not present, so...
Okay.
So, I guess...
Mr. Kunkel, would it be fair to say then that really the gist of House File 2442 is... really the utilization in technology to ensure the protection of the producers and the movers of our agricultural produce in the state. Would that be a fair assessment?
Mr. Chairman, that's a good summary, yes.
Okay. Is there any questions to Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kunkel, you said there's no opposition to this. What is the position of county recorders on this bill?
The county record,
Representative Swenson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, you asked about the county recorders. The county recorders had representation at the meetings where this was put together and discussed. There is a representative of the county recorders present today who indicated to me before the meeting started that their organization was involved in this and they are not opposed.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might have missed this. I had constituents in my office, but every time the word lien comes up, I raise a red flag. And it talks about updating the liens. Does it change in any way who gets the first lien, who gets the second lien, who gets the third, and can you tell me in order who gets first lien and who gets...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Otremba, nothing in this system affects the priorities of liens or security interests. Liens or security interests in farm products are determined under Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code. What this system is designed to do is to protect buyers of farm products so that when they buy the farm products from the producer, they take the livestock and grain free from all liens and security interests. So nothing here affects priority of liens or security interests.
Representative Tremba?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It said that in your summary, it says you're updating and improving an already effective notification system. Can you tell me how that's being upgraded?
Mr. Kunkel?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Otremba, we believe it's updating the system by facilitating electronic filing and distribution of information. It'll be possible for the buyers to obtain the information electronically in a more efficient manner from the central filing system, and it will allow lien holders and lenders to file those effective financing statements and lien statements electronically as well.
Follow-up, Representative Tremba?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an example. I rent out my land, and in order to secure my rent, I get part of the payment. Last year, I didn't get the payment, so I called the office, and Harvest State had gotten it. And there was no notification to me at all, even though I thought I had the first lien.
Mr. Kunkel, would you care to comment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tremba, under Minnesota law, a landlord of agricultural property can obtain the first priority lien on farm products grown on that property. In order to perfect that lien, it's necessary to file a financing statement in the UCC records. So if that was done, it would have been possible to get your name put on that check.
Is there anything else, Representative Otremba?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Heidgerken, do you have a question?
Thank you, Chair Blaine. Yes, I do. In regards to the bill itself, basically what I need to know is how is this in general going to affect the farmer? Is it going to be more work for him?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hyder, it shouldn't be. It shouldn't affect the producer one whit, in the sense that the system is used only by the secured lender, the bank who's financing the farmer's production, who files an effective financing statement in the system, and by the buyers to whom the farmer sells their products by registering to obtain the notice. So it shouldn't affect, you know, it shouldn't require them to sign any more documents than they did under the old system.
Representative Heidgerken?
A follow-up. I noticed that the filing fees have changed and some have gone up, and there's some I've been paging through it that have been begun because of this. How much more of a cost will this be for the average farmer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Heider, my understanding is that the fees have been adjusted to be consistent with the same fees as charged under the Uniform Commercial Code system, and it's a uniform fee of $20 per document. The fees for the buyers of products and those who obtain the list from the central filing system have been adjusted slightly, so that I suppose it may be possible that those fees are going to be passed on, but they're not, for the most part, material changes.
One follow-up here.
Representative Heidgerken, one more.
Chairman Blaine, yes. On page four, I'm just looking at some clarification there. You have listed the crops, and I'm wondering why this would be that you specifically do that when I see that there are other items, tomato, cabbage. I know there's mint fields in Bonanza Valley, there's snow peas in Bonanza Valley. A big crop down there is asparagus. And some of these, don't have to be in compliance, or?
Mr. Kunkel?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this list came primarily from the existing rules that had been adopted by the Secretary of State's office before. As part of the bill, we're repealing those rules as well. We have added several additional commodities this year. And quite frankly, at our task force meetings, there was a lot of brainstorming regarding products that could have been included and were not included. And the listing that's included here is just simply the product of the group that worked on the bill.
Okay, thank you.
More questions here. Representative Magnus, you are next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kunkel, I've got a couple questions. I noticed that a list comes out once a month, and I have a question of who gets that list, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Kunkel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Magnus, the list is provided by any buyer who registers with the Secretary of State's office. If they register and if they subscribe to the list, essentially, that list will be provided. It's currently under the existing bill, it's provided in a hard copy format, and under the existing statute in a microfiche in at least one other electronic format, which apparently doesn't even exist anymore. So that's one of the other reasons for the bill. But it's a subscription service, essentially.
Representative Magnus, do you have a follow-up?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Black, I understand there's a fee for that, but there's no fee if it's transmitted electronically. Is that correct?
Mr. Kunkel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Magnus, that's correct. That's one of the changes is that it should facilitate the use of the system by buyers as a result.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Magnus.
How do you determine who the buyers are? Who has access to the list? Is it just anyone that wants to get it electronically, or how do you do that?
Mr. Kunkel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Magnus, that's correct. Buyers, there's a strong incentive for buyers under the law. If the buyer subscribes to the list, they get the protection. They get the protection that they purchase commodities free of liens and security interests. If they don't subscribe to the list, they don't get the protection. So the way the system operates is that the buyers are incented to subscribe to the service, obtain the list and the information. If they then find that their seller is included on the list, then they know who may be asserting a security interest or a landlord's lien or a harvester's lien, whatever, in those commodities. And that's the way the system operates and has operated since enactment.
Follow-up, Representative Magnus?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Black, what about other liens that a farmer might have on his for example, if I buy a tractor and I borrow the money, does that go on the sheet? We call it a sheet back home. Yeah. We call it a something sheet, yeah. Because it's distributed pretty widely, and a lot of people get to see it. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people know what everybody's doing.
Mr. Kunkel, maybe you could clarify that for Representative Magnus and the rest of the committee members here, too.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Magnus, if there's a security interest in a tractor, it shouldn't be appearing on here. It should only be included on the sheet if someone asserts a lien in farm products in the enumerated, products.
Okay, one more question, Mr. Chairman.
Not a problem, Representative Magnus.
Mr. Chair, in regards to termination, I see you've got dates in here and that specify the termination provisions on this. In practice, how is that going? Is it when someone buys my crop, for example, and that lien is satisfied, how long does it take to get off of there in practice? What is a normal time that you're doing this?
Very good question, Representative Magnus. Mr. Kunkel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Magnus, I can only tell you my experience. I don't operate a filing office, but that is a problem. That's a problem under the Uniform Commercial Code, and it's a problem under this system. Both the UCC and this system have built-in requirements that can that provide that lien holders and secured parties are required to file termination statements or provide termination statements to their customers. I believe under the bill and under the existing statute, there's a requirement that they be provided within 30 days and provides for some civil penalties if they fail to comply. But quite candidly, that's a potential problem. I know that there are some lenders, none of whom are my clients, of course, who believe in keeping those out there because it's just much easier. Because if you go out the next year to provide additional financing, you don't have to file again. And that's the reality.
Yeah, they like to keep their bank, your name on your check. I know that.
And I've been involved in a number of cases where we have 6 and 7 parties' names on those checks. I'm sitting on some of those green checks right now.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Swenson, comment?
I guess I'll address this to Mr. Kunkel. Could the person who the lien is impacting, could they go and request that it be taken off if the lien has been satisfied? You said some of them just leave it on, but I mean, could you go and request to have it taken off? Then they would have to comply.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Swenson, yes, they could. And under the Uniform Commercial Code, because remember that ties in here too, there are penalties for failing to terminate within those time periods as well. Okay. I think lenders are becoming more cognizant of that.
I just have one follow-up. Mr. Chairman and Mr. Kunkel, is that a change? This bill isn't changing present situation in this regard? Is that correct?
Mr. Kunkel?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Swenson, no, it does not.
Okay. Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question. It has to do with the liens again. As of August, as you know, life estates and joint tenancies no longer exist, and so what's happening is if you've used any health care and that person dies, you get a lien put against your property, and it's becoming very common in my areas where the intent to file a lien is going on farm properties. And then the state gets the first lien. So does the notification then only come out on the subscribed buyer list? Or do they actually have to notify, like Harvest States, that they now have second lien instead of first lien?
Mr. Kunkel.
Representative, or Mr. Chairman, Representative Otremba, I guess I'm not real familiar with that legislation, but if there would be a lien on these products, that type of lien would not be within the coverage of this statute, because this only applies to farm product statutory liens as defined in the statute, and those are essentially enumerated in the statute. So that's going to be a potential issue at some point down the road.
Actually, Mr. Chair, we are already seeing some actual liens, and they're in court right now. So
okay.
It's more than potential. It's happening.
Representative Swenson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in that regard, and I'm not 100% sure on this, Representative Otremba, but I believe the things you're speaking of are probably more apt to be liens on property, on property, real estate, and maybe not necessarily on the crops.
Actually, Mr. Chair, it now includes assets also.
I think that's another issue that this bill isn't addressing.
Further questions here. Representative Demmer, you are next on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. One, I was curious, on the financing statement, we need to show where the product was located. Now has either produced or located. And I'm interested in that because oftentimes things are produced in one place and located in another. I would think you'd want to know the location if you were a lien holder. Can you comment on that?
Mr. Kunkel?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Demmer. You just hit on one of the little issues that was an 11th-hour change that we scrambled to accommodate. That was a change in the federal law. Congress made that change. We've been in contact with people at the USDA trying to get an explanation, and we haven't obtained any sort of explanation. The reason we made that change in our language was to make sure that our statute tracked the federal statute. But I'm sorry, I don't have an explanation for that, and I share your concern because we think it could potentially create an ambiguity, but we can't draft this statute based upon a blank slate. We have to conform to the federal act.
You had a follow-up, Representative Demmer?
Yeah, just a comment on that. It seems awkward. I think probably not too often anymore that things are actually stored where they're produced, so that's very curious. And one other question, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Certainly.
On the list that Representative Magnus referred to, I noticed that one of the ways that they store that is in order of Social Security number. Is that Social Security number on that list? And in these times of security or of identity and that sort of thing, can that list end up in somebody's garbage pail or garbage can that anybody can pick it up and say, oh, I got a nice list of Social Security numbers here?
Mr. Kunkel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Demmer, you've now hit the second problem with the federal act. We don't like that, and we've talked about that. Again, that's in Section 1631, the federal statute. It was in there when it was originally enacted. We don't know for the life of us why that wasn't eliminated in 2002 by Congress, but it remains in the federal act. As to whether or not someone could obtain that, you know, those Social Security numbers, I'm sure they could if somebody didn't shred those documents, if they obtained it in a paper format. I guess I hope personally that by incenting buyers to use the electronic distribution system, it'll eliminate that risk, or at least, you know, limit that risk a little bit, because that information will be provided electronically rather than in paper. But that's an issue, but it's not one that we can address, unfortunately.
Representative Demmer, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, in both of these issues, there are new language and a new bill here. How's it being done now? Are these both these things being? Are we doing it where they're produced, and are we currently distributing lists of people with Social Security numbers on it?
Mr. Kunkel?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Demmer, as currently operated, the system has to identify where the crops are produced, and the current system does require Social Security numbers, so that represents no change in that regard.
Representative Demmer,
follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in actuality, this is the way it's being done now. We're not going to start implementing this, but it's something we do want to address, I think, and try to change. In reality, are buyers able to access this information online, and are they really looking at it that way as opposed to getting lists? Is that accurate to say?
Representative Mr. Kunkel, response?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Demmer, the online access isn't currently available. We're hoping that it will be, and when we were meeting, when our task force was meeting, the buyer representatives who were there indicated that they were really interested in that means of access, simply because everybody is becoming more accustomed to obtaining information that way. And they'll be able to obtain it quicker.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank
you. Okay. I think our last question, Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I forgot it now that Demmer got some good issues out on the table, but it related back to the liens. Oh, I do remember. Representative Swenson or Mr. Kunkel, you were talking about the liens, and that is still a problem. Why don't we fix that in this bill and make it a little stiffer so they get the liens off? And if we're making a streamlined change here, it seems to me this would be the place and time to do that. Why can't we get that added in either here or on this bill before it travels through to the to the House floor?
Mr. Kunkel or Representative Swenson, but we aren't really changing the lien format with this legislation. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom, we talked about, in our task force, we did talk about encouraging people to file those termination statements. The consensus of the group, and bearing in mind that we did try to reach a consensus here and did, was that we didn't believe that we could get that consensus if we put in much more teeth into that provision. Secondly, the enactment of revised Article 9, we thought, that actually does have increased penalties included for failing to provide termination statements, we thought we should give an opportunity for that to work before we increase those penalties any further. So, no, there are no changes in that regard contained in this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
So it was considered with this when they came forward. It seems to me the ag groups would be the ones that would want this change. But if you're telling me, what was the penalty again for not removing a lien within 30 days? What did it go up to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom, under the Uniform Commercial Code, it's now been increased up to $500. And under this legislation, it's $100. So, if those are not duplicative. Those are different documents. So potentially, there's a $600 per document civil penalty available. And quite frankly, we didn't believe that that the lenders who are participating in this project would be excited about being exposed to more liability than that.
So well. Hopefully that's enough then, but it seems they want it streamlined, but they don't want liability exposure when they got somebody wrapped up in their name on their check. Seems like they want it a little both ways, but anyways, it's just an observation.
Thank you, Representative Westrom. Representative Pennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How often do you enforce that?
Mr. Kunkel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative that's up to the producer who's adversely affected. That's up to the farmer whose checks are being withheld, and so it really depends. There's nobody out there who is enforcing that other than the parties affected.
Representative Pennis.
So is the system working or not,
Mr. Kunkel?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pennis, we believe it is. We believe it's working very, very well. The primary purpose, remember, of this statute is to protect buyers of the farm products, to make sure that they aren't getting sued and having to pay twice for the commodities.
Representative Pence.
Just to follow up, I'd like to add that it's lucky if they pay once.
I'm going to ask members here if they have any other questions. Otherwise, in an effort, we've got a lot of work today, in an effort of time here. I need to ask if there's anyone from the Minnesota Association of County Officers that has a question pertaining to House File 2442. If you would stand and come to the table if you have a question. Okay, thank you. Members, we have a lot of testimony on Representative Swenson's House File number 2442. If there is no further discussion.
Mr. Chairman, and if there are no further questions, I would renew my motion on the bill, that the bill we recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. And I guess I would remind the committee members that as long as it's going to another committee, there will be opportunity for further questions.
House File 2442. Members, all those in favor of sending this bill to civil law, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The bill is passed and sent to civil law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next bill on our calendar today is House File 2461. Representative Cornish, are you ready to present your bill?
Mr. Chair, members, first a technical question on House File 2461. I have a one-word change to make. Delete and insert, and I was wondering if it would be proper to do it before presented the bill or after.
Representative Cornish, you probably need to move your bill first and then move the amendment. I mean, we won't vote on the bill, but I think it'd be you need to make the motion for what you wish to have happen to the bill.
I'd like to move House File 2461 and recommend it to pass, and this point, I'm not aware where it goes to the general register. I'm not aware of any other stops it has to make.
I guess I'm not aware of that either. But I guess if that's your motion, then Representative Cornish moves that House File 2461. Okay, Representative Cornish, I think my committee administrator just reminded me that we probably will lay this bill over for inclusion in our omnibus policy bill. So we'll take the testimony and go from there.
Sounds copacetic to me. Mr. Chair, I have that one-word amendment to make this time. It'd be okay. On page 2, line 35, the first word there where it says instrument, I would strike that and insert document.
Insert which?
Insert document in place of instrument, page 2, line 35, the first word.
Did everybody get that? Representative Cornish moves that oral amendment that on page 2, line 35, the word instrument be stricken and the word document inserted. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary? Carried. Representative Cornish, you can proceed with present your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, what I have here is an e-commerce bill here, a Right now in grain elevators, grain buying stations, and grain buying companies, grain producers are using paper documents for transactions. But this bill will allow the use of electronic documents in place of the paper documents. And as far as I know, there's no opposition. I did run it by a couple of farm groups, and it didn't seem to raise any red flags. I don't have any of them to testify in favor of it, but nobody's come out in opposition against it. It's a Department of Ag agency bill, and with that, I would turn it over after that lengthy introduction to the Jim Grineski, who is the Assistant Director of Ag Marketing and Service Division of the Department of Ag, for the walkthrough of the bill, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Proceed with testimony. State your name for the record. And
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Grineski. I'm Assistant Director of the Ag Marketing Services Division of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Welcome, and proceed with your explain your bill.
This bill allows for the use of electronic documents in the place of paper documents in certain grain transactions. There are two statutes that address buying and storing of grain. The grain buyer statute is Minnesota Statutes Chapter 223, and the grain storage statute is Minnesota Chapter 232. So there's definitions that are applied to both those statutes, defining what an electronic document is, what an electronic signature is, and stating the circumstances under which an electronic document can be used in the place of a paper document. In regard to electronic grain warehouse receipts or grain storage receipts, there's another provision that assigns some responsibility, or I shouldn't say assign some responsibility, but addresses the responsibility of managing these electronic documents. The United States Department of Agriculture is establishing rules with regard to electronic warehouse receipts. There will be a central filing system with vendors licensed by USDA. And they're allowing state-licensed warehouses to use their system when it comes into place. So in essence, what we'll have is a central clearinghouse that's licensed and bonded by USDA that will ensure the safety and security of electronic warehouse receipts when it's in their central filing system. This will, by having the states work with the USDA on this issue, it reduces the responsibility of states to establish their own bureaucracy to set up their own systems and do their own review of the qualifying nature of the vendors. Some advantages to having electronic documents that can facilitate the trade of grain between grain firms. It can with regard to warehouse receipts. One of the problems producers sometimes have is that they're issued the paper receipt by the warehouse, and they may lose it when it comes time to wanting to get paid for their grain. They can't find it, and there's some other paperwork has to be done for them to get payment. My understanding is that in the future, Farm Service Agency of USDA may require electronic warehouse receipts to be provided by producers for collateral for loans. So we want to set up the system and make the use of electronic warehouse receipts and other documents available to producers and to local elevators when the time comes.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the Representative Junkie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. As we move into this paperless world of ours, my concern is I see that on this bill, this is going to be electronic signature registered and authenticated by a vendor credited by the United States Department of Agriculture. How is that coordinated within the state? Because currently I know the Secretary of State is working on electronic real estate recordings, and they've got a whole uniform system for that they're setting up with certain authenticated signatures that will be acceptable to the Secretary of State, Ms. Kiffmeyer. And how does the Department, are they in contact with the Secretary of State? I mean, I can see this eventually going to UCC filings and other things that will be paperless, but if all of a sudden we've got a USDA-approved system and now we've got the Secretary of State in Minnesota saying, no, we can't take it, it's got to be this type of signature, electronic signature, is the Minnesota Department of Agriculture working with Secretary of State on these things to make sure that we're uniform so we're not getting a mishmash system with every department coming forward with their own criteria for electronic documents? Who is the clearinghouse in the state for that, or who should be?
Mr. Granowski?
I wish I had a simple answer for your question, but I think when I was drafting this bill, I was working under some presumptions of that the federal that USDA would be establishing credentials and working with other participants in the Uniform Commercial Code to have a uniform system, but I have not talked to the Secretary of State's office on this.
So, Mr. Chair, and I guess I would ask you before this progresses in any omnibus bill or anything to have a chat. I know Mr. Black was supposed to be here today for another bill. Bert Black would be the one to talk to in that office. Run this by him and see if this is going to cause any future headaches in compatibility, because I do want the state system to be as seamless as possible. Many times we go off in our own directions, and I want to make sure that we're, if you would give me that assurance that you'll at least visit with him on this.
Mr. Ganowski?
Representative Junkie, Mr. Chairman, that's why our intent with this is to make this not to create another level or conflicts anywhere, so yes. I will talk to them.
So probably you would have some conversation before we put the bill together, which would probably be next week sometime.
Okay.
Any other questions? Representative Westrom?
Representative Cornish, to the witness, just another thing that I'm wondering about. What do you have in the bill that would require the electronic document they create to also be accessible from an adaptive speech or adaptive type of software on the computer, and if not, could we put something in there on that as well?
Representative Cornish or Mr. Ganowski?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom, we don't have language in there now, but it'd certainly be acceptable to us to make any modifications that would make that easier for access for all people who are involved.
Representative Westrom, if you wish to talk with him about possible changes, you could do that. Sure. Any further questions? If not, this bill will be laid over for inclusion in our omnibus policy bill. And thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next bill on our calendar is House File 2658, which I am the chief author. I think I'm going to just present it from here. And Mr. Jerry Schoenfeld, did you wish to come forward to the table? And maybe I'll ask Mr. Schoenfeld if he wishes to. I know he's been involved as well as some others in drafting this bill. If you'd care to give some comments on the background and so forth.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I represent today the Minnesota Pork Producers Association. But I'm really kind of here from a little bit of a different perspective in the fact that, oddly enough, sometimes you have to come back and fix things you did years ago. And Mr. Rankin can probably remember from some years ago, in 1982, I was the chief author of the original legislation when this bill was passed. And it, at that time, was supported by all the groups. I don't think that's necessarily the case with this bill today, but in 1982, the Farmers Union, the Farm Bureau, and all other farm groups did support the bill. And it was a bill that was intended to provide some weight in the balance of justice on that scale that you see with the blind blindfold over the face, to provide some balance on the side of farmers that had agricultural operations, particularly when people moved in from outside and then wanted to declare them to be a nuisance because they didn't like a number of the things that were happening. I'd like to point out a couple of differences between when the bill originally passed, the law went into effect in 1982, and today. In the fact that today, in 1982, there was very limited zoning in a number of parts within the state. That's been 20-some years ago. And we didn't have all of the zoning regulations and so forth that we do today. In addition to that, other things such as the federal laws, local ordinances, feedlot ordinances, I would guess that probably back at that time, for instance, there were no local feedlot ordinances, there were no feedlot officers, there was no 70-20 rules by the MPCA and a number of other things. So a lot of the things that regulate in an area have come into play since that time. Basically what the bill does before you is it says that it provides a positive, affirmative approach to nuisance defense. And what it says is that if the agricultural operation is located in an agricultural zoned area, so first of all, it has to be in an agricultural zoned area. Secondly, that it complies with the provision of all applicable federal, state, or county laws, regulations, rules, and ordinances, and any permits issued for the agricultural operation. So it has to be following all the laws that govern it. And thirdly, that if it does those things, an agricultural operation operating according to generally accepted agricultural practices, and then it further states what those accepted agricultural practices are, which are basically the practices that are followed by farms generally operating in the area in the county. And it states that it must not be considered to be operating in a negligent manner as a matter of law. Now, if you look to the last part of the bill, the provisions of this subdivision do not apply, and there's a couple of stricken pieces there because we felt that it was taken, that those were provided for in the fact that we were looking at an affirmative operational standpoint. So that, for instance, if a farmer were doing something that was illegal, or if he was operating negligently outside of what is accepted agricultural practices, that they would not be covered under the bill. And originally, when the law first went through, it included that you couldn't pollute any waters of the state, and it is also limited to 1,000 animal units, and that has not changed within the bill, so that this nuisance protection is affected for basically a smaller and medium-sized farm, and above 1,000 animal units has not changed. That provision has been there since, I think, in the beginning. Question may come up as to what a nuisance is. A nuisance, basically defined is in a nutshell, is that it limits the use and enjoyment of property. And of course, this is somewhat of a property rights issue, and there's always two property rights in the case of the farmer's property rights and someone else that doesn't like what a farmer is doing. And this does put some weight on the side of the farmer in terms of his defense. I was asked a question earlier today, does it stop a lawsuit? Well, I don't think there's anything that we can pass in the legislature that stops lawsuits, but it does put some weight on one side or the other as you look at the situation. There were some recent lawsuits that were brought on this legislation, and this attempts to deal with some of the issues involved. One of the questions was, under the old law, it stated that they had to be farming for 2 years and that you couldn't be a nuisance at the time you started. And the question was, well, how do you prove whether you are or not? And so we tried to put some further definition, and that really is what the bill is about. With us today, because I am not a lawyer, and as most of you know, Mr. Clevin is, so I think he had some comments that he wanted to make, and also Dave Preisler from Minnesota Pork Producers to give a bit of a practical perspective on it. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, unless there are any quick questions about just what the bill is and a little bit about the history, I would step aside and allow these gentlemen to come up.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenfield. And I need to make the motion that this bill be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. With that, thank you. And Mr. Preisler, did you have some additional comments, additional testimony? And Mr. Clavin, if you want to both come up to the podium to so we can move along as quickly as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record.
All right. Mr. Clavin.
Yeah, thank you. Bruce Clavin, representing Minnesota Turkey Growers Association, also the Broiler and Egg Association. I also work for the Minnesota State Cattlemen's and the Association of Cooperatives, and I know they would have an interest in supporting this bill as well. Jerry covered a lot of the points that I would have made in terms of the bill and what it does. He described what a nuisance case is, and a nuisance case generally is about interference or enjoyment of property, things like odor, noise, dust, that type of thing. The nuisance law, as I look back, some parts of it came as early as 1907. It was amended in 1921, 1937. The ag section, the protection for ag operations, came in 1982. But this isn't something that was invented last week or during the feedlot battles we've had here since 97. This has been for a long time. It was protecting farms from dust and noise and odor claims. Some of the things that have been found to be nuisances, and this information is from a legal encyclopedia called Donnell's, racetracks, gun clubs, shooting range, stone crushing plant, grinding mill, smoke, that type of thing. We've heard of cases where combines or township or somebody had talked about having an ordinance where you can't run your combine after 10 p.m. because of the lights, the noise in the lights, which it's not just a feedlot deal. So those things can happen. It depends upon the time of day and so forth. As Jerry mentioned, too, and a point to make for you all, is in 1982, this business about the size was put in the 1982 law. This is protection for 1,000 animal units or less, and that was in the original 1982 bill, and so 1,000 or more still could be subject to nuisance claims. So this isn't a corporate factory farm kind of agenda deal. This is what we would see as a small to medium from our point of view. In terms of the bill and what was done so that you can see how this tracked and what we're attempting to do here, in one of the court cases that was reviewed last fall, the judge had some concerns or maybe some confusion over the two-year provision. You see it stricken out on line 10 and 11. And that was put in as sort of a statute of limitations, that if you don't bring your nuisance claim within 2 years, you can't ever bring it. And in the ruling, the judge was saying, well, gosh, when does the 2 years start? How do I know if you were a nuisance before the 2 years? And there was really no way to determine that. So the answer is strike that out. Let's remove that confusion and just say that ag operation is not a public nuisance or private nuisance if you do two things, and Jerry referenced them. You're in an ag-zoned area. You can't put a pen of horses on Nicollet Mall because that's not an ag-zoned area. You could be sued for nuisance, for example. And you comply with the rules. Now, some of these things were brought before the feedlot rules were in effect. And we came last year with an EAW bill relating to compliance with the rules. And we've been told with PCA and folks over the years that if we comply with the rules, we get to farm. So that section was lifted. What you see in line 14 to 16, that was lifted out of lines 19 to 21, basically. And that used to work under the old bill if you followed the common practices. Instead of arguing about what common practices are, we just moved it up saying if you comply with the rules, you can't be sued for nuisance. You can be sued for something else, violation of the Clean Water Act, that type of thing, violation of your permit, but not for nuisance. So we end up striking that out later on in the bill. And then we get to the section on the common practices. And this section is currently in here. There's a little bit on the back. But ultimately, the attempt here is to say, if you do get sued, and again, Jerry said you can always be sued, it's whether you win or not. If you're sued, you won't be negligent as a matter of law if you're following the practices in the area. And if you comply with them, that compliance is an affirmative defense to any nuisance claim you might encounter. And you'll see on lines 24 to the other side, what's the definition? Jerry referenced that again. This is the second point that I saw in the case. The judge says, what's the definition of that? How do we know what commonly accepted animal practices are or ag practices are? And so our effort was just to say whatever in the county, because it varies from the Red River Valley to the Karst region, for example, whatever is done locally, you could introduce evidence to show that you're in compliance, and that's the effort. I would point out to members on lines 14 to 17 that, again, that less that over 1,000 is not apply, and so we keep it in a small to medium area. Anyway, that's the effort, and that's the explanation of the bill members.
Thank you, Mr. Clavin.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Junkie.
So Mr. Clavin and those lines 14 through 17 are talking about swine and cattle feedlots. How does that relate to poultry that you're talking and representing up there?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Clavin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I hadn't looked specifically at the language on 14 and 17 for the turkey side. We wanted to make sure that none of the claims could come. In answering your question, I guess poultry could be sued. We could not be sued under this, even over 1,000. Because this language says that swine and cattle could be.
And that, Mr. Clavin, I believe that's existing law. That's not the
Yeah, and
changed.
Again, that, Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie, goes back to 82. This, I don't believe this has changed since 82. I copied that off. We'd like to review it, but the cattle and the swine parts were in 20-some years ago.
Representative Blaine?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Clavin, in regards to lines 14 through 17 on page 2, then, if we have a facility, if I have a facility that I've got more than 2,500 cows on, is there any protection in law that, or is there anything in statute now that would give me protection currently right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Blaine. To my understanding, there would not be any protection for over that. That's what the point of the provision is. It would be less than that. So the nuisance claim could still exist potentially there.
For larger operations.
Mm-hmm. That's right, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ochemba, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What if they currently are under 500 units, let's say, and then they expand? Does that start all over then again, or are you just protected all the way through up to 1,000 without any reconsideration?
Yeah, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Clavin.
Yep. To answer your question with the 500 animal units, if that's where you are and you're going to expand, you have to get your permit, and you would be protected up to 1,000 under this bill.
If that would be a nuisance to a neighbor, then they couldn't sue?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Trevin, what you're saying is correct.
That's providing they adopt, they're in an agricultural zone, and they abide by all the rules and regulations, I believe. Representative Ochemba.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question. We know that a lot of the seeds being planted are GMO, and they're next to organic farmers. If something would happen as far as drifting into the organic, even though that person has been there for a period of time and had never used GMO before and now start to be used, there's no way for that organic farmer to sue?
Mr. Clavin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tremba. Not under nuisance. I think you could make a trespass claim, possibly, because the seeds would be trespassing over onto the neighbor's land. That would be more the nature of the claim, I think, than the dust, odor, noise kind of situation. The trespass, having the seeds go across, as I think the way the claims have been brought in other parts of the country, I think. And if I was taking the case, I probably would explore a trespass claim before a nuisance on a GMO seed issue. I think it would be stronger.
Mr. Representative Demmer, did you have a question?
Well, that was quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question, Mr. Klavan. In general, what's the purpose for the limitations on size? If you're complying with all the laws and that sort of thing, you're agricultural, why have a limit above which you can be sued for nuisance? I know it's been there for a long time, but what's the rationale for that?
Mr. Klavan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Demmer, I can't think of a reason other than the 1,000 numbers used a lot. It was there in 82. We thought it best not to monkey with that. But would our members support that? Probably, but it would be probably more of a lightning rod than it is, already is. So we just felt it would be less best left alone at this point.
Thank you. Mr. Preisler, or Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Klavan, I was just wondering, and I guess it piggybacks a little bit on what Representative O'Trimble was talking about as far as lawsuits being brought. I was wondering how many of these lawsuits are brought by family farmers in these cases?
Mr. Jimba, Mr. Klavan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eakin, I really don't know. I don't know what that is. We saw a case, and we're responding to that because our interest was keeping the ag protection, again, not just for livestock, but combines and whatever else. We're concerned partly with urban sprawl and folks moving out there and some of those kinds of issues, too. So there's other things that are involved in that, but I don't know, have an answer to your question.
Thank you. Mr. Preisler, do you have some additional information for us or additional comments?
Sure. For the record, my name is Dave Preisler. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Pork Producers Association, and thanks for the opportunity to just bring out a couple of things. Mr. Klavan and Mr. Schoenfeld talked about a lot of the issues that I was going to address, and so I'll keep this very brief and keep it really to how it's working in kind of practicality. We have had a farm sued and actually is in the process of the lawsuit, and that farm is actually less than 1,000 animal units. And so this does enter into that. It's also a farm that has had extensive air quality monitoring and has never violated any of the air quality monitoring standard or any of the standards that are out there, yet still has ended up being sued and having to defend itself. And it's also a farm that is very common in its kind and its type in southern Minnesota. And so one of the things that obviously we're concerned about is what kind of an effect that it would have on all farms, again, especially those that are less than 1,000 animal units, and how farmers are going to look at that down the road. As you look at a farm trying to manage risk, this one ends up being kind of a risk that's really unknown. And you know, what's going to happen as far as some of these suits. And so what we're looking again to do is to kind of shift that just a little bit, understanding though fully that farms need to comply with the rules and the laws that are out there. And they have changed substantially. And actually, if we look at that class of feedlots that are over 1,000 animal units, some things that they have to do now that they didn't even have to do before are to have an odor management plan filed, to have an odor response plan filed. Like those things weren't even required until just very recently. And also they end up going through environmental assessment worksheets, which oftentimes brings with it air quality modeling requirements. There's a whole host of things that end up happening on those feedlots that, again, weren't even required when this legislation was written. One of the other things that it's not only the people that live, you know, or the next door neighbors today, but it's also who are your next door neighbors going to be down the road. And it's not necessarily even if somebody builds a new house, but somebody you know, just buys the house that's already there. And what's going to end up happening with that, and what kind of risk does that carry with it? One other thing that I think you know, there may be some concerns about is that, well, is there any way that some sort of an entity can bring something? And I guess, as I understand it, at the very bottom on in lines 18 through 21 is that, you know, you could still have something that could be classified as a public nuisance. So in essence, a county could still bring something forward, you know, if there was something that we're really not anticipating here. There is still that sort of a piece that's still there. With that, I'll stand for any questions.
Mr. Klavan?
Mr. Chairman, I have one additional point. I got off my notes, and I promised the townships I would make this mention so they didn't have to come down here. Townships contacted us this morning about concern here. On one of the lines on the front page, it's county, state, and federal, and they weren't in there. And we talked a little bit about that. They didn't have anything prepared today. They may be covered on page 2, lines 18 to 21 that Dave just referenced, but I promised them I would mention that to you all that we talked and we're going to talk some more before civil law so that they wouldn't have to come down here and make a statement.
Thank you. Do we have questions? Representative Otto, did you have a question?
Excuse me, you must have read my mind, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, well, I'm just reading the notes my assistant
okay.
writes.
Thank you.
The name
then
she writes down.
You're good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was thinking inside my head here. So let's say that there's somebody who has a complaint, and certain farms will be protected under this. So let's say they make a complaint, doesn't the farmer still, aren't they going to have to prove that they're following all the laws? Isn't there going to be some sort of a process that they'll have to go through anyway to prove that they're using common practices and that they're following all the federal, state, and local laws? Is that correct?
Mr. Clavin?
Mr. Chairman, members of Otto, the defense would be used if there was a court action. So the complaint, let's say there's a complaint, call it the PCA, there's some manure running down the river. That would be the PCA coming out, issuing you a fine under your violation of your permit and the state feedlot rules. So the commonly accepted practices would be, I would envision them to be in a court case if there was a nuisance claim. Then you'd have the chance to introduce the evidence that, not that everybody lets stuff leak, but maybe everybody runs their combines all night, or the sugar beet growers use their trucks all night, and that kind of thing, so that you'd be able to defend yourself should there be an action. But if there's a complaint, I would imagine to be the first step would be the PCA, now that the rules are in effect from 2001 forward.
Okay.
Representative Otto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this would be for either of you as well. When there's a change in the law, usually there's a reason for it, and I've been trying to listen and track all of what you all have been saying. Is there a certain type of farm operation that this current law is not working for, that is having problems?
Mr. Clavin or Mr. Preisler?
I think that really to respond to that, and I don't know that there's necessarily a certain type, although, again, the one that is currently in its process is less than 1,000 animal units, and so that makes it interesting because that's supposed to be covered here. But I think that it's more a case of the original legislation was probably, you know, a little too subjective, and we're trying to make this a little bit more objective to where it's a little bit clearer. We're still even just a hair uncomfortable with, you know, comparing the practices to other farmers in the county, you know, because that still has got a certain degree of, it brings some of that back. But we couldn't think of anything any better, quite honestly. So what we're looking for are some things that I think are a little clearer and provide just plain more of an affirmative defense that if I am, as a farmer, following all the rules and the regulations, federal, state, locally, if I've got a conditional use permit, following all the conditions within there, that I've got, I guess that I can sleep at night knowing that, yes, I may still be sued, but hopefully I would have a little bit better shot at prevailing.
Representative Penas, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is for Mr. Clavin. Is there a farmer nuisance law that exists that addresses the number of animal units in urban sprawl?
Mr. Clavin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Penas, I didn't look that up before the hearing, and I don't have an answer to your question.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Clavin, am I right that the farmers would also have some rights? You know, I noticed nuisance such as smog, noise all night, helicopters, and stuff like that. Now, I know that that's a part of life, but, you know, we've got a lot of animal units down here in one congested spot.
Representative Peterson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I want to follow that, but sorry. I have a question for Mr. Rankin. In the overview,
proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the overview, you explained clearly that through a series of amendments over the years, the defense has been expanded to cover virtually all farm operations that have been in existence for 2 years or more. And it's the next sentence that I'm interested in is that the exceptions are made for the first 2 years after substantial expansion of an operation for large swine or cattle operations. I guess my question is, what lines are those? Is that sentence referred to? And specifically, in either of you at the table can jump in. I believe last year we during environmental review we changed the definition or time constraints, if you will, around expansion. Like, if it's less than 1,000, which the animal units for swine, which I think a lot of barns are about 9, under 1,000 by design. So I guess I'm interested in the definition of a site, which is 999999999 within the first 3 years of that operation's expansion. Does that, under last year's environmental review change, does that operation, is that exempt from nuisance?
Mr. Rank?
Which would be more than 1,000 on one site, but yeah. If the site is defined as 999 or less, you see what I'm describing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson and committee members, the expansion part is in the definition, which does not actually, it's in the subdivision 1, the definition section, which mm-hmm. does not display here on this bill.
Okay, thank you.
And it talks about significantly altering, and the current law says that if there's a significant alteration, which tends to mean 25% or more increase in animal numbers,
mm-hmm.
Then that triggers it as a, in existing law, it triggers it as a new operation with a new window of up to 2 years for potential liability.
Mm-hmm.
The amendments in House File 2658 eliminate any mention of a new or renewed 2 year window of exposure.
Okay, that's kind of what I thought. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
And Mr. Rankin.
Members, I would just say that if there's anybody here, the fourth bill on our agenda for today, we apparently aren't going to get to because we are supposed to be out of this room at 2:15, which gives us 10 minutes, and I still have, I think, three people that have asked to testify on the bill we're on at the time. So if there's people waiting for the final bill, we'll probably have to reschedule that. Mr. Tom Peterson, did you wish to testify? And I guess in the interest of time, if you could be as brief as possible, because I have a couple other names to
try to ever talk to. I'm going to losing my voice too, so. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Peterson, and I'm Director of Government Relations of the Minnesota Farmers Union. And while I understand concerns raised by this bill, and I understand the issue very well. I grew up on one of the last farms in Excelsior, a good-sized farm in Excelsior, and it was not uncommon for us to see lawsuits filed against our own farm. And, we were discharging phosphorus into Christmas Lake, or our horses were our stallion whinnied at our mares at night. Those laws were thrown out because, my dad's an attorney, but also, they didn't have merit, you know. It's got to have merit, you know, to have a law. I'm kind of, you know, what are we doing here today? I'd like to know how many nuisance lawsuits, how big a problem is this? We didn't have a lot of time to prepare for this bill. It was just introduced. And coming forward, I'd like to know, I put it out there in my members, I don't see a big problem with this. Some of the questions I do hear coming back, and unfortunately, I'll hate to see this. We talk about this all the time, but I think in a lot of cases, it is a farmer versus farmer problem, and we always hate to see that, but unfortunately that's the way it is. And if a farmer comes forward and files suit against another farmer, we hate to see that, but a lot of times that's the problem. If it's in your area and you got a problem that you can't get the county to address, or you can't get the PCA to address, you know, what you're a farmer and you got a problem, what are you going to do? Who's your next step you're going to take to? And that's the concern I have, and that's what I feel has been able to be addressed by the nuisance lawsuits. If it's got merit, it's going to go forward. If it doesn't have merit, it's going to go forward, and it's going to get a jury hearing by a jury of your peers. They get to hear, they get to make the decision, and they get to judge the case on its merits. So that's my basic statement is that I don't see any reason to change the law right now, because if we're doing this on one case and one judge, I feel that the law works well. It's been, you know, nuisance laws suits have been, nuisance law has been in place as common law for hundreds of years. So with that, I want to make sure that we protect also the rights of farmers and residents, too, to be able to address concerns through a nuisance lawsuit that has to be dropped. We've heard the same thing. We talked about this at our convention a lot, that even Representative Pennis brought up. Our president, vice president of Farmers Union, the Cowles Moo at night, he lives in Cambridge. We talked about sprawl. Somebody brought up urban sprawl. But, you know, that's an issue, too. But I feel that the language in this bill, that we got to be careful here, because what are we doing? What are we changing it for? Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Ms. Peterson, Representative Cornish?
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Peterson, the problem I have is you've described it right there. You said you couldn't get the county to do anything. You couldn't get the PCA to do anything. Maybe the reason you haven't got the PCA and the county to do anything, there isn't anything wrong. And then you're one thing you're left with is being a nuisance and throwing in the nuisance law and standing in the way of a farmer's production that is obviously abiding by the laws. So I think you described the problem. You can't get anybody else to do it, and you pull in this archaic law up here and then get in the way of a legal operation. And I just wonder what you think about that. Why should you be able to pull this old law out when they're abiding by the regulations with the state and the county?
Mr. Peterson, do you have any response?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cornish, Representative Cornish, I'm a farmer, you know, and I'm a farmer, and you're a farmer, and I've got a problem, and I can't address this, and archaic law, but it's, you know, I'm not sure what total you're going down by that law. I should still have the right to, you know, as an American, to question that.
Representative Peters, did you have a question?
Yes, if Representative Cornish is done.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Peterson, to the earlier question that I asked regarding the changes that were made last year during the session to environmental review and some of the requirements to the 70-20s, I believe, in relation to those changes and now this bill, given how Mr. Rankin described it, what effect do you see with these two working in tandem with each other regarding nuisance and the new 70-20s, or the changes that we made to environmental review within the first 3 years of a swine operation expanding, which is, you know, the word is used in the overview. So,
okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, it could have a substantial, and when we do see that, you know, in cases where, you know, in western Minnesota, and again, we didn't have a lot of time to bring people in that have brought nuisance suits against people, because I think that would be interesting to hear from people and maybe some different cases on why nuisance suits are brought, and hear some actual farmers talk about the actual case. But, you know, if you have 900 and 900 and 900, you know, and you were there first, you're farming, and maybe you have 900 animal units, or you have and again, what's your right as a farmer?
Mr. Peterson, you mentioned 900, 900, 900. If they were all on one location, you'd be over the 1,000 limit. But anyway, Representative Temba, did you have a question that I overlooked?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to re-ask the question that I'd asked earlier to Mr. Clavin about, and I think it's what we're discussing now. If you have 350 cow herd animal units and you go to 500 animal units, do you have to start over again with your, and that's what you're discussing now. So obviously it looks like you don't have to start over, that you can just expand, correct?
I'm not positive on
well,
that.
Well,
I just haven't gotten a clear answer.
I would just, you know, I think Representative Tremba, I think if you have an expansion, you certainly have to abide by the rules and regulations, you know, that are in place, and the zoning, and get your permits and so forth. if you're going to do an expansion.
Exactly. But, Mr. Chair, what I'm saying is sometimes that nuisance or whatever you want to call it happens when you expand. In my area, it's always been the farmer fighting against the farmer, and it's always when they're where they've all been about the same size, and then one of the dairy farmers or whoever expands, and it's always been the farmers around them that are upset with the expansion because we have a lot of water in our area, so there's diseases that are spreading in the creeks, and it's always been a farmer when they've all been the same size and then somebody going up another 300 or 400 units. And if they don't have that opportunity to say that that's a nuisance because of Yon's disease in the creek that runs down to theirs, it seems a little bit unconstitutional to me.
Yeah, but Representative Tremba, we do, and I don't want to get in an argument, but we have regulations on where you build and how you build and how your facility is impacting, possibility of it impacting waters and so forth. So anyway, any other questions for Mr. Peterson? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
We have about 5 minutes left in our time, so I have Mr. Paul Subasinski and Karna Peters, and are you both coming up together? And
yep.
And I'd remind you that we need to be adjourning in 5 minutes. So, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. And
I'm Paul Subasinski. I work with the Land Stewardship Project. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. We are opposed to this bill, House File 2658. It basically eliminates the right to bring a nuisance lawsuit, effectively eliminates the right to bring a nuisance lawsuit by putting out what is considered affirmative defense and striking current nuisance language. It takes away neighbors who often are farmers' rights to bring a nuisance lawsuit. Look at the language that it strikes. Affirmative defense is a defense like it's okay if everyone does it. It would be like changing the speeding law and saying affirmative defense when talking to the officer when he picks you up. Everyone else is going 80, you know, that's my defense. Or saying to the judge, that's my defense. Mm-hmm. I particularly like to call your attention to lines 9 to 10. When an agricultural operation causes injury or direct threat of injury to the health or safety of a person. You know, you're striking that language. And one of the reasons that we're up here in terms of the Land Stewardship Project is that when our organization looks at issues, we try to look at a total picture of how things affect the farmer and the community and the environment. And if you look at the summary of Sam Rankin here, I mean, you're saying very directly, the amendment removes existing limits to shield against nuisance claim if an agriculture operation causes injury or direct threat to a person's health or safety. Public officials, in my opinion, ought to put that piece in terms of public policy at the forefront. And for that reason, we're opposed to this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you,
Ms. Peters,
and about 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Karna Peters. I'm a lawyer. My office is in Alexandria, Minnesota. I live in Glenwood, Minnesota, so I'm a constituent of Representative Heigerk, and I haven't had the pleasure of meeting you, but you've sent some nice notes to my husband, so thank you for that. I have several comments on this proposed legislation. First of all, if this legislation is adopted and if it's challenged in court, a court would hold this unconstitutional. The Supreme Court in Iowa, in the Borman case, held similar language unconstitutional, and the reason is that this amounts to a taking of property rights. It sets up an easement over a farmer's property. It takes away a person's right to be free from nuisance conditions, and many law review articles have discussed this in similar laws. Our firm has represented people in a few nuisance cases in the past year. Not very many cases, because I want you to know that it's very difficult under the existing nuisance law that we have right now to bring a nuisance case. It's a very high standard for someone to meet. In the cases that we've worked on, all of our clients have been farmers. They're family farmers. And I'm going to repeat that again. Our clients are farmers. They've suffered miserable conditions because of neighboring livestock confinement operations. They've spent years trying to get the MPCA and the counties to enforce the laws, and they've been unsuccessful in doing that. Their only redress has been the courts. And unfortunately, because there's been such short timing between the time that this bill was introduced and this hearing, these types of people can't be here today to talk to you, and I think it's important. I'm very concerned about the process here as a lawyer. This is a very important piece of legislation that has constitutional implications, and to be introducing it and hearing it with such short notice, you're not giving the public a chance to give you input on this legislation and how it might affect them. I think that's a bad process that will lead to bad law. I want you to be very careful here about this language. I think there's been some misleading statements that have been made today. And this goes back to Paul's comment. If you look at this language here, there have been suggestions here today that if an operation complies with all the laws, you can't bring in, an operation doesn't comply with the law, you can bring a nuisance case. That's the suggestion here. But then if you go down to lines 23 to 25, it says, compliance with generally accepted agricultural practices is an affirmative defense to a nuisance claim. And that means practices commonly used by other farmers. So what happens here as a legal matter is that even if you show that the operation is violating the law, and in one case we had a situation where an operation was violating the county setback requirements, even if you show that, if the operator, livestock operator, comes back and shows that they've got generally accepted agricultural practices, you've lost your nuisance claim. And generally accepted agricultural practices, I think they could argue, well, we've got a confinement. There are a lot of other operations in the county that have a confinement. So, you know, that's a complete defense to the nuisance claim. And so farmers are going to lose their ability to bring nuisance claims under this law. And I say that based on my experience because just a few weeks ago we got a call from a farmer who said that the practices of the neighboring farm were affecting their dairy production. And they were concerned about that, and they wanted to know what their legal rights were.
We're running out of time.
And there was a question asked earlier about why this legislation has shown up. And I think there are two reasons. One is that there's an effort to take away the right to bring a nuisance claim even if an operation is violating the law, because I think that's what this language does by saying that generally accepted ag practices are a complete defense. Even operations that violate the law could be exempt from nuisance claims. Also, I think that there's an effort to shield livestock contractors from responsibility for nuisance situations. There have been two significant court decisions in the last year in cases that we have worked on, one by a federal district court and one by a state court in Minnesota, that have held that the contractors on confinement facilities are also responsible for nuisance situations because the contracts with the actual operators of the facilities, the growers, the livestock contractors have so much control over those operations that the courts have found that they should also be responsible for nuisance situations. So I think there's an effort to shield from responsibility, and I think that should be a very big concern for the members of this committee.
Thank you. I guess I would just like to say in response to a couple of the statements you made, you said they could be breaking the law and still be forbidden from taking new. I think if you read lines 13 through 15 through 16 on the page 1, it specifically states that they have to be in compliance with all state or county laws, regulations, rules, and ordinances, and the permits. And you also stated that a case of some place where somebody didn't abide by the setbacks. Now, that would certainly have to be addressed at the time they were building, they wouldn't get their permits and so forth if they didn't comply with the county, with the zoning ordinances.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly the point that I was getting at, is that the law says, okay, it's not a nuisance if it complies with the rules. But even if you show it complies with the rules and the regulations, if they come back and say and show that, argue and convince the court they have generally accepted agricultural practices, that's a complete defense to a nuisance claim.
We're going to have to get out. I think there's another committee looking for this room. But Representative Cornish and then Representative Jonke, and we have to be
real quick.
Very briefly.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm a little upset with the testimony. First of all, the Farmers Union came up and said there wasn't a problem. Hardly any claims were out there, and why do we need the law? Through a couple of questions from members, then all of a sudden it turned into a huge problem, and it could be a huge problem for western Minnesota. So what is it, a little problem or a huge problem? It changed in 5 minutes. Then we have a firm that makes tens of thousands of dollars off of these claims come and tell us they don't want us to change the law. Well, I imagine not, because if we do change the law, there's going to be less claims and less financial impact to their firm. So I'm having a problem with the direction this is going here.
Thank you. Representative Jonke.
Well, Mr. Chair, just quickly, I don't have a problem moving this bill on, but I certainly do agree that there probably are some questions and problems. Nuisance law is an old law. I don't think that the Ag Committee will be changing it. Frankly, this is going to civil law, where, Mr. Chair, I'd be very surprised if this doesn't change in form if you're ever going to get it out of that committee. I know the attorneys that sit up there, and they are going to review the nuisance law, and if there's problems, I think that's where the major testimony. We're getting law testimony now, Mr. Chair, which we're not qualified, I don't think most of us, unless Erdahl's going to law school. Oh, Westrum's here.
Representative Jonke, that was going to be my statement, because we need to move on, but my that remind the members that this, if we pass this out of here, it will be going to civil law, and there'll be opportunity there if you wish to address legal issues. But so with that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2658 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion is carried. With that, members, we're going to have our next meeting, we're going to have at 10 o'clock Monday morning. We have bills to get through next week's, and we won't be able to do them in one meeting. So with that, the meeting adjourned. Yeah.